Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you think, because our language has the word mind, and it's used to identify people, how does that work? I mean, you know, does that reinforce your concept of possession?
Mm-hmm.
And if it does, how do you avoid
that? Okay. So the word mind, you're saying, it's a word that we use in society in general to denote possessions. And do we have to stop using that word, or you know, what kind of, how does, yeah, how does that relate? Okay, the word my or mine,
mm-hmm,
is a word we use, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we have a societally agreed upon conception of ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you know, we trade pieces of paper for a certain object, then we all agree that we can give that object the label mine. Or if we give that object to somebody else and say, this is yours, then we all agree that that person can then give that label mine. Okay, that's perfectly okay, you know, just having that agreement, and we agree that there's ownership, and, you know, it's a way of differentiating things. There may be lots of water bottles, and it's easier to say, please, can I have my water bottle, you know, because that's the one I'm going to drink from, not somebody else's. So, you know, it's a convention, and there's nothing wrong with those conventions. Where we run into trouble is when we forget that these are only conventions, and we think that they have some kind of intrinsic value or meaning to them. That's where we run into trouble. Okay? When I think that it isn't just a convention that this is mine, but I think that there's something inside of it that is mine, and therefore I'm attached to it, and I don't want to let it go, and I have all these expectations of how it should relate to me, or how that person should relate to me, and how other people should relate to whatever I consider mine. So it's our clinging to mine that creates the problem. It's the attachment to mine, okay, that creates the problem, not just the convention. Okay? But you see, we often don't differentiate between those. Yeah, we kind of blur them together. When we say, you know, these are my glasses, it's just the convention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But as soon as somebody walks on these glasses and crunches them and I need them, then in my mind it's not just that they're my glasses, they're my glasses.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference between my and my. No, because the whole way I relate to them is very different. Okay? Yeah. That's a very good question. And so sometimes the more stuff we have, the more it's easy for us to get quite attached to having a lot of possessions. Even though we don't mean to, the mind of attachment kind of does that. The group in Seattle, when I was their resident teacher, I gave them a homework assignment. We were talking about generosity one week and miserliness, and, you know, because miserliness is a form of attachment. And so I gave them the homework assignment of cleaning out either a closet or a dresser or something that hadn't been cleaned out in a while, and taking out everything that you have not used in a year and giving it away. Because if you haven't used it in a year's gone by, four seasons have gone by, you haven't used it, chances are you won't, you know, slight chance you will, but maybe chances are you won't, and give it away. And, you know, we talked about how much positive potential or merit that you create by being generous, and how much generosity is karmically is the cause of wealth, and it helps us to have a good rebirth and all that kind of stuff. So we talked about the karmic benefits of generosity, and also how good we feel about ourselves when we're generous. And gave them this homework assignment, And then the next week they came in and, you know, kind of we talked about how we did. Well, some people didn't do the homework assignment. You know, some people, they went to clean things out and they saw, it was one woman, I saw this T-shirt that I bought in Mexico, was it 15 years ago? I completely forgot I had it because I haven't used it in so many years. But I saw it and I didn't want to give it away because it reminded me of my trip to Mexico 15 years ago. And so we talked about this. Here's something that she didn't even know that she had. She'd completely forgotten about it. So if somebody had taken it away, she never would have missed it. But as soon as she saw it, the attachment mind came, you know, and couldn't give it away. So it went back in the drawer to sit. Yeah, probably still hasn't been used, but it's back in that drawer. So, you know, but it was nice because we really could talk about this quite honestly. Then some people, you know, they got their box to the door, but they couldn't get it to the trunk and to the charity. Other people got it in the trunk, but it didn't make it to the charity. Yeah? So it was so fascinating to watch the reluctance we have to separate from stuff, even when we don't use it. Yeah? And to watch, here we're talking about possessions, not people, but how to watch how that term my sinks into the object as if it's some physical thing in the object that makes it so that we can't separate.
Attached to what they could be, because you know, helping some sort of pain.
Okay, so you're talking about a situation where we develop an image of somebody that we project on them of everything they could be, yeah, and there's red flags going up all over the place about how they aren't that, mm-hmm. and how they probably have no intention of becoming that. Mm-hmm. But we ignore the red flags because somehow we're just really stuck on it, on them. And so how do we get ourselves out of that? Okay? What I found is I have to, recognizing when I'm doing that, you know, and saying to myself, you know, attachment is in the mind. You know, I have to say that. Yeah. Attachment is coloring the mind. This is not who this person is. Yeah? And then look at the red flags and say, you know, there are red flags. Yeah, I need to look at those red flags. And then remembering past situations where I ignored the red flags and I ignored the fact that it was attachment, and remembering how painful those relationships turned out. Because it always turns out painful, doesn't it? You know, when we start to get involved with somebody that we want to be something that they aren't, and we're ignoring the flags, it always turns out so painful because we're so infatuated with them, and we fall in love with them, and then they aren't who we want, and then we feel hurt and rejected and abandoned and let down, and we're fighting with them, and it's just, it's so ugly and it's so painful for everybody. So I think remembering what we've been through before and say, why am I doing a rerun of something that causes me pain? Yeah? Kind of been there, done that. Why am I doing this again? You know, there's some kind of instant rush at that moment. But I know very well that this instant rush is totally deceptive. You know, it's like falling in love with a face in a mirror. That's what it's like. You know, you're falling in love with a face in a mirror. There's no that person's not there. Yeah, it's completely deceptive. So why am I doing this? You know, I need to restrain myself. And so in those situations, I deliberately stay away from the person, you know, because I know that if I let my attachment, you know, have any say in the thing, then I'm just going to do a rerun of the bad situation. But it's you know, sometimes attachment is so clever. Attachment says, oh, but they're going to feel hurt if you stay away from them now. You know, just try being nice and kind to them and try having a good relationship this time and don't hurt their feelings by backing away. You know, so we say that to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we know full well that that's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But so we have to start calling ourselves when we're lying to ourselves like that. Yeah? And for me, I know just remembering the pain of the previous situation often is like, no. No sense doing this again.
Related to that is the whole notion of discernment. When you were talking before about community, and you know, sometimes we don't have a choice about our community, our family, and other times we do have a choice. And so when we have a choice about joining a community or developing a friendship or whatever, discernment becomes very important. And sometimes I get caught up in the notion that, well, this person has crossed my path for a reason, and you know, or this group of people, or and so maybe there's something for me to learn here, and I should stick around. But you know, I mean, how do you know when you want to join a community or be part of a community if it's right for you or not? You know, how to make that discerning judgment?
Okay, so how to discern when if that's a good community for you to join or to be a part of? Yeah.
Or a friendship,
or whatever else. Yeah. I think some of the things what we'll get into about how to choose friends, and really asking ourselves, what kind of people do I want to be around that will help me grow and who I can help grow? Okay. Now, given that what I was saying before about sometimes the person who harms us is our best friend, but at least there, if we can recognize that that person has stuff and, you know, see it in that way as I'm learning from this person instead of getting attached to them, and you know, beforehand. But I know for myself, I look and I say, first thing I look for is a person's ethical conduct. You know, and really looking at someone's ethical behavior and how they behave in different situations. And, you know, are they truthful? Are they honest? Are they only nice to the people they like and then they backbite other people? Because I know as soon as I meet somebody who backbites, I know one day they're going to do it to me. Yeah. At the time that they might be backbiting, I might see it as, oh, you know, they're really trusting me and telling me this confidence, and the two of us are making ourselves the best ones in the world because that one's so lousy. But really, it's true. You know, when somebody starts bad-rapping somebody else behind their back, we know that one day or another we're going to be the person they do that to. I mean, it's natural. It's natural. Somebody's not always going to like us. So I am very cautious around people who do that. Yeah? And I don't try and also, having said that, I think there's a difference between sharing information and backbiting, because sometimes you do need information about other people or whatever. But that's very different, you know, than deliberately criticizing them, putting them down, and slandering them. Yeah. Okay. So I look at that. I look at, you know, is this a person who seems to get angry and judgmental a lot? If they do, do they recognize it and try and remedy it? No, because for sure, if they're an angry or judgmental person, they may like me now, but one time or another, sometimes their anger and judgment are going to come out with me. You know, no matter how much we seem to get along right now, that's not ever going to last. I mean, we all know it, don't we? Because one person we feel good about one day and bad about the other day, so same way they're going to do that to us. So, you know, if I'm really fond of this person and I think, you know, good things of them, then I also have to be prepared one day for their anger, because some day or another they're going to be mad at me. So how do they act when they're angry? And how quickly do they jump to anger? And are they, you know, willing to discuss things when they're angry at other people, or do they just bad rap those people and then retaliate? Yeah? So I'm really looking at somebody's ethical conduct. That's a big thing for me, you know, because it really shows you kind of who you can trust. And of course, there's not going to be, you know, you're not going to meet a bunch of perfect people. But the thing is to at least see if somebody is trying and if they have some willingness, you know, to work on themselves. I mean, nobody, of course, is going to be perfect, but at least, you know, I find I want friends who I know are trying to work on themselves and who know that I'm trying to do that. Okay. A friend once told me that he was talking with a professor of, I don't know, physics or something like that at Stanford, because his partner was thinking of giving them an endowment or something, you know, something like this. Anyway, the point is, they asked that professor, what qualities do you look for in prospective graduate students, the people that you're going to take on as your students? And that professor said, I look at how they handle problems and failure. And I thought, wow, that's really smart, you know? Because when somebody's happy and successful, you know, we kind of know how they act. But when they run into a difficulty, or when they've tried something and it hasn't worked and they feel like they failed, or when they've met with some frustration, how do they react to that? You know, because that really gives you a much clearer idea of the person. Mm-hmm. So I think things like that can be helpful. Okay. Let's just sit quietly for a couple of minutes, digestive meditation, and contemplate what we talked about.